Picture the scenario, right? It is a freezing cold morning, in the year 1743.
Okay, setting the scene.
Yeah, we are in this tiny parish in Dumfriesshire, Scotland. A Church of Scotland clerk is sitting at a heavy wooden desk. His breath is probably, fogging in the air.
Right.
And he cracks open his thick, leather-bound register book to write down a baptismal entry. A father is standing in front of him.
Okay.
The clerk asks for the family name, listens closely to the man's heavy Scottish brogue, dips his quill in the inkwell, and writes down Makeswell Makeswell.
Which, I mean, from the clerk's perspective, that was a completely accurate phonetic transcription. He
Exactly.
wasn't lying to the historical record, and he wasn't even making a mistake, at least not by the orthographic standards of his era.
Right. There were no standardized dictionaries sitting on his desk.
Exactly. He was simply recording exactly what he heard using the spelling conventions he had available to him on that specific Tuesday in 1743.
Right. So fast forward 300 years to the present day. You, sitting at home, are a genealogist.
A frustrated one, probably.
Yeah. Well, you know your stuff. You understand the fundamental mechanics of building out a family tree, and you're hunting for your ancestors. But you are looking for the name Maxwell, Maxwell.
Right.
So you type that into your genealogy search engine. The search engine scans millions of documents, looks at the clerk's entry, sees Makeswell, and immediately decides, nope, not a match.
And just skips it entirely.
Exactly. You completely miss this massive, crucial branch of your family tree because of like a phonetic spelling choice made by a guy who's been dead for 2.5 centuries.
It is an incredibly frustrating scenario for any researcher. And unfortunately, it's really the rule rather than the exception when you're dealing with historical
It's
records.
so common.
Yeah, and it highlights a fundamental flaw in how we have traditionally digitized our history.
Which brings us to the mission for today's deep dive. You, our listener, already know the broad strokes of how genealogy works,
We're
right?
skipping the basics today.
Exactly. Today, we are stepping past the beginner stuff and going straight into the advanced architectural
The
weeds.
fun stuff.
Yeah, we are looking at the foundational database structures that hold our history, specifically a system called the Max Record Schema. Because if we are ever going to solve that Makeswell problem, we have to completely rethink the underlying foundation of how we store historical data.
We really do. We have to draw a hard, impenetrable line between evidence and interpretation.
Okay, evidence versus interpretation.
Right, that is the core philosophy driving this entire system. Max Record acts strictly as the evidence layer of a much larger architectural ecosystem called AMAXed GIN.
Okay.
Its entire purpose, its prime directive, really is to represent a single document exactly as it was found in the real world.
So no tweaking it.
None, not as we wish it was found, not as modern grammar dictates it should have been written, exactly as the ink dried on the page.
Let's unpack that distinction because separating evidence from interpretation, it's a massive paradigm
It
shift.
is.
When I look at a poorly constructed historical database, it feels a lot like looking at a photograph from the 1800s where someone has taken the file into Photoshop and painted like modern jeans and t-shirts onto the subjects.
Just to make it easier for a modern audience to relate to.
Right. But by doing that, you have fundamentally destroyed the actual historical artifacts.
Because the artifact is the ultimate truth of the moment in time it was created.
Exactly.
So when we talk about the Max Record Schema, we're talking about a structure that captures only what is physically observable on the document.
Just the raw data.
Right. It captures the transcribed text, the source URL where the digital image lives, the date literally written on the record, the location exactly as it was spelled, and the raw strings of names.
So it stores the literal word Makeswell.
Yes. The interpretation, the human or algorithmic leap of logic that says, I am fairly certain Makeswell, is actually a variant of the modern name Maxwell that does not belong in Max Record.
Okay, so where does it go?
That determination lives entirely separately in another conceptual layer called Max Person.
Okay, let me push back on this purist approach for a second, though.
Sure.
From a sheer usability and like software engineering standpoint, aren't we just creating extra steps?
How do you mean?
Well, if a really well-meaning indexer is looking at that Dumfriesshire baptismal record and they know the family in that area is ultimately the Maxwell family, wouldn't it just be faster and easier for the end user if the indexer just fixed the spelling to Maxwell right there in the initial data entry?
It seems like it would be.
Right. Like, why not just save everyone the extra processing power and correct the typo at the source?
Because that well-meaning correction is exactly the mechanism by which you permanently poison a historical data set for future generations.
Poison it. That's a strong word.
It is, but it's accurate. And this becomes a catastrophic problem when we enter the age of artificial intelligence.
Okay, how so?
Well, in a standard, older database model, if an indexer fixes the spelling during data entry, the original text Makeswell is permanently lost to the computer system.
Oh, because it's overwritten.
Exactly. Now think about the mechanics of what happens when you train future AI models on that specific database to read old handwriting.
Oh, wow. The AI is looking at the original image file, which clearly features the ink strokes for Makeswell.
Yes.
But the text data it's being fed by the indexer says Maxwell.
Precisely. The AI is just a pattern recognition machine trying to learn how to read 18th century cursive.
Yeah.
It looks at the physical loops and curves of M-A-K-E-S on the page, and the database tells it, no, those loops and curves spell M-A-X.
So it learns a completely false correlation.
Yes. Moving forward, it learns to transcribe Maxwell whenever it encounters the physical word Makeswell, because that is what its flawed training data dictates.
That's terrifying. You're basically teaching the machine to hallucinate historical records based on a well-meaning volunteer's assumption.
Exactly. And it's not just Makeswell. You know, think about German immigrants. A clerk writes down M-U with an La L-E-R Miller.
But the indexer modernizes it to Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R.
Right. Or an Irish record says O'Brien, O-B-R-I-A-I-N, and someone just types in O'Brien with an apostrophe to be helpful.
So the AI learns to completely ignore the actual ink on the page for all those names too.
Right. That single well-meaning correction compounds into millions of automated hallucinations across the database.
Wow. Okay. When you consider the scale at which AI is being deployed right now, that is a massive issue.
It is. MaxRecord prevents this compounding failure because it operates as a rigid scientific system.
Like the scientific method.
Exactly. In the scientific method, you never alter your raw observational data to fit your working hypothesis.
Yeah.
The original observation is preserved in the evidence layer.
And the correction.
The correction, or the normalization, is noted in the interpretation layer as a probabilistic assertion.
Okay, wait. By probabilistic assertion, you mean it's essentially a highly educated mathematical guess with a receipt attached.
That is an excellent way to phrase it. Yeah. It is an assertion saying Makeswell is Maxwell, coupled with a confidence score and a direct link back to the exact piece of evidence that prompted the guess.
Ah, I see.
So if that interpretation later turns out to be entirely wrong, the original evidence is still sitting there in the Max record vault, untouched, pristine, and waiting for a better interpretation.
The human error remains entirely recoverable.
Exactly.
So you lock the raw evidence in an underground vault, and you do all your tinkering and theorizing out in the laboratory.
That's the perfect analogy, yeah.
Okay, so if we are radically committing to preserving the exact truth of a document spelling, how does this schema handle information that is inherently vague?
Like what?
Because history isn't just full of weird spellings, right? It's full of terrible record keeping.
Oh, it is incredibly messy. Human beings were not always great at tracking time.
Exactly. I'm thinking about dates. Like, if a family letter or a diary entry says an event happened in spring 1847,
right.
A standard computer database usually demands a specific timestamp. It throws an error if you don't give it a month, a day, a year, and maybe even a time zone.
Yes, it forces you to pick.
So how does MaxRecord handle a date that is basically just a shrug in a season?
This is actually one of the more elegant architectural solutions within the schema, I think.
Okay, how does it work?
MaxRecord handles dates using a flexible range-based system rather than a fixed timestamp.
A range-based system.
Right. It utilizes specific fields for year min, year max, month and day.
Got it.
So if a document says spring 1847, the schema records the year min as 1847 and the year max as 1847. But it intentionally leaves the month and the day fields completely blank.
Because spring conceptually spans months 3 through 5, and we literally do not have the evidence to be more precise than that.
Exactly. Storing a precise date when none exists in the source document is essentially manufacturing a lie.
It really is.
Standard databases that force a researcher to pick March 1st just to satisfy a required data field are actively corrupting the historical record.
For sure. It's like forcing a specific date onto a vague historical event is like throwing a dart at a calendar while blindfolded.
Yes.
You are definitely going to hit a number, but it means absolutely nothing in reality.
Exactly. MaxRecord embraces the uncertainty because in historical research, Storing a range is often the only truthful representation of the data.
Which makes sense, especially since historical dates are notoriously untrustworthy to begin with.
Oh, incredibly untrustworthy. Consider a death record in certain rural 19th century jurisdictions.
Okay.
Because of distance or weather, it might have been officially filed weeks or even months after the actual death occurred.
Right. Or consider census records.
Oh, those are the worst.
The age or birth year written down by the census taker was often self-reported by someone who, frankly, might not have known their exact chronological age.
True. Or worse, the census taker knocked on the door, no one was home, so they asked a neighbor who just guessed.
Exactly. The neighbor says, yeah, I think old man Jenkins is about 60. And suddenly, through the magic of a rigid database, that guess becomes permanent, unquestionable historical fact.
So a range-based date representation isn't just a clever software workaround for a broken system. It is the philosophically correct way to model historical reality.
Okay, that makes total sense.
And location data gets the exact same treatment.
I want to hear about the locations. Because if spelling and dates are messy, geographic borders are an absolute nightmare.
A total nightmare.
They change constantly depending on who won the last war.
Right. So in Mac's record, there is a dedicated field called Place as Written. It holds the literal verbatim text from the document.
The exact text.
Yes. So if the 18th century clerk wrote Kilpatrick Parish, Dumbartonshire, Scotland, that exact unedited string of text is saved to the database.
Even if Dumbartonshire literally isn't a recognized county anymore, or if it was spelled wildly differently back then.
The original string is preserved no matter what.
But doesn't that make it hard to search?
Well, no. That doesn't mean the data is unsearchable for a modern user. That literal text is later paired with optional normalized fields like modern country codes, states, or provinces.
Okay, so you still get the searchability.
Right. And it can also be linked to a place registry in the MaxPerson layer for what we call historical polity resolution.
Let's define historical polity resolution for a second. You mean tracking how borders, empires, and jurisdictions physically shift over time.
Exactly.
Because Dumbartonshire in 1740 might fall under a completely different administrative jurisdiction 50 years later, and the search engine needs to understand that those two different places are geographically the same spot.
That is exactly what it means. It's mapping the historical string of text to a specific set of geographic coordinates and tracking who owned that land at that specific moment in time.
Wow, okay.
But the foundation of that resolution always begins with the exact words written on the page.
Okay, so we've mapped out the when, or at least the truthful range of time, and we've mapped out the exact where.
Right.
But a genealogical record isn't really a map or a calendar. It is fundamentally a record of people interacting with each other.
Absolutely.
So if we are capturing the exact ink on the page, how does the schema handle the actual human beings mentioned in these documents?
It utilizes a structure called the persons mentioned array.
An array.
Yeah, in database terms, an array is just a list. This specific array holds the names of every single person mentioned in the document, transcribed exactly as they are written.
Okay, so no normalization here either.
None. They're not normalized, and they're not yet linked to a master identity profile. It is just the raw names stored alongside their designated roles in the event.
What do we mean by roles in this context?
We're defining the relationship of the person to the document. Roles include things like the principal subject of a birth record, a witness to a marriage, the officiating minister,
right,
a neighboring landowner on a property deed, the informant who reported a death, or the head of a household on a census.
Okay. Anyone who has ever tried to manage server costs or database performance is going to look at this and see a massive storage problem.
You think so, yeah.
If I am looking at a massive 20-page probate inventory from the 1800s, that document might mention 15 or 20 different people.
Easily.
Now, maybe only two of them are the actual ancestors I care about researching the principles.
Yep.
The other 18 are random court clerks, the guys who appraise the farm equipment, witnesses, and neighbors. People I am never going to build a family tree for.
Sure.
So why are we using up database real estate and processing power to save 18 random names? Why not just extract the principal ancestor and discard the rest to save space?
Well, if we connect this database structure to the bigger picture of how historical research is actually conducted, dropping those 18 names destroys one of the most vital pieces of historical evidence we have.
Which is?
The social network.
The social network. You mean their 18th century friend group, essentially? Their community?
Exactly. In genealogy, it's often referred to as the FNN club, friends, associates, and neighbors.
Yeah, I like that.
People in history did not live in a vacuum. You know, they did not farm in isolation. They certainly didn't migrate across oceans in isolation.
Right. They traveled in packs.
Exactly. Often, when you hit a brick wall in your research, you absolutely cannot find where an ancestor originally came from. The answer is not going to be in their own personal records.
Where is it?
It's hidden in the records of their neighbors. Extended families migrated together. They married into the same small religious groups. They co-signed each other's loans. They adapted and survived as a community unit.
So if I hit a brick wall trying to figure out where my principal ancestor in New York came from, the answer might actually be sitting in the profile of the random guy who signed as a witness on his marriage certificate.
Yes.
Because it turns out they both came on the exact same boat from the exact same tiny village in Ireland.
Exactly. If you design a system that only extracts the principal person and throws away the witnesses and neighbors to save database space, you are actively erasing the context of their life.
You're cutting the ties.
You are severing the historical ties that explain how they move through the world. By forcing the system to store everyone in the person's mentioned array, MaxRecord ensures that the entire community ecosystem survives in the data.
It's not just a family tree, it's an entire forest being preserved.
That's a great way to put it.
But let's talk about the logistics of this. Because if we are refusing to leave anyone out, saving every neighbor, every witness, every vague date, that is an enormous amount of complex text to pull from a single page.
It's a lot of data, yes.
How does a computer actually read a dusty old book and extract all these interconnected people without hallucinating? I want to understand the pipeline from the physical book to the digital record.
Let's walk step by step through the journey of a document then.
Okay.
We'll go back to our Scottish baptismal register from the 1740s.
Mm-hmm.
First, the physical book gets digitized by a camera. A raw image file, usually a high-resolution TIFF, arrives in the system's pipeline.
So at this point, the computer doesn't know what it's looking at. It just sees a grid of pixels that happens to look like a page.
Exactly. Then a specialized system called Max Recognition takes over.
Max Recognition.
So this is the artificial intelligence transcription engine. It analyzes the contrast of the ink against the paper, studies the handwriting patterns, and generates a word-by-word text extraction.
Oh, wow.
But crucially, it also generates confidence scores for how mathematically sure it is about each individual word. This analytical output is what actually creates the Max Record.
When the AI, this Max Recognition system, looks at the handwriting, what happens if it's just completely illegible? Old cursive is basically a different language half the time.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that is where the confidence scores are vital. The AI doesn't just confidently declare, this word is Makeswell.
Okay, what does it do?
It outputs a data point saying, I am 92% sure this word is Makeswell, based on my training.
Oh, I see.
If the confidence score drops below a certain threshold because the handwriting is terrible or the page is damaged, the system can flag that specific word for human review rather than just guessing blindly.
So the Max Record is born directly from the AI's transparent scored transcription of the image.
Yes.
It captures all the metadata, the array of persons mentioned we just talked about, the literal range-based dates and unedited places.
Exactly. Now, once the Max Record is locked in as the immutable evidence, a new process begins. A separate agent called MaxTask takes over.
MaxTask, what does that do?
Its job is to extract the genealogical meaning from the raw evidence. The MaxTask agent reads the Max Record, identifies the array of people, and then creates or updates living profiles in the Max Person layer.
So MaxTask is the bridge where the interpretation finally happens.
Right. It links the interpreted person profile back to the original source record ID. And this is where a subsystem called the MaxName schema kicks in.
Okay.
It looks at the evidence the string makes well and makes that probabilistic assertion we discussed earlier, concluding that this is likely a variant of the master identity Maxwell.
It is a brilliantly unbroken chain of custody.
It really is.
You go from a raw, pixelated photograph of a 300-year-old book to a literal AI text transcription with confidence scores to a linked probabilistic assertion about a human life made by an extraction agent.
All neatly connected.
And because they are entirely separate layers, you have a perfect audit trail. If another researcher comes along and says, why in the world do you think his name was Maxwell? You can trace the logic all the way back to the specific stroke of pixelated ink on the original TIFF file.
That rigorous audit trail is the defining characteristic of a scientific data system.
Right.
But as we follow this pipeline, we have to talk about how we handle modern data versus historical data.
Why is that?
Because the Max Record Schema doesn't just hold 300-year-old Scottish books. It is designed to handle 22 different record types.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the documentation mentions vital records, naturalizations, military drafts, and even recent DNA evidence records.
Exactly.
If this pipeline handles everything from the 1700s to modern DNA results, you are going to hit a privacy wall incredibly fast.
Like really fast.
How does the system handle something highly sensitive, like a recent DNA test result for someone who is still alive, compared to an ancient census record?
Every single Max record, without exception, carries a mandatory field called a redistribution license.
A redistribution license.
Right. It is not an optional setting. The system architecture literally forces the creator to declare exactly how this specific piece of data can legally be shared.
Instead of just throwing around the licensing acronyms, let's break that down. We are talking about a spectrum of privacy here, right?
Exactly. The spectrum ranges from CC0, which means the record is entirely in the public domain, and anyone can use it for anything.
Right. Completely open.
All the way down through various attribution licenses, until you hit the most restrictive level. Tier 2 private.
Tier 2 private.
A Tier 2 private license means the data is locked and can absolutely never be redistributed or shown publicly.
And how does the system know when to apply that lock? I saw something in the architecture notes about an is-living flag.
The is-living flag acts as an absolute hard privacy gate within the schema.
Okay, so it's automatic?
Yes. If the is-living flag on a record is set to true, which it would be for a modern DNA test result, the record is automatically and irrevocably forced into the Tier 2 private license, regardless of any other user settings. Oh. Living people simply do not appear in public datasets. The system will not allow it.
Okay, but plenty of genealogy apps and social media platforms have privacy toggles, right?
Sure.
What makes this implementation fundamentally different from me going into my settings and making my profile private?
Because the privacy toggle you are used to is an app-level toggle. It exists in the user interface.
Let me make sure I understand the difference. If it's an app-level toggle, the underlying database itself is still completely open.
Right.
It is just the website's visual interface that is deciding to hide the data from my view.
Exactly.
So if a hacker, or even just a developer, downloads the raw database, they can see absolutely everything, regardless of my toggle.
That is precisely the vulnerability with most systems. But because Max Record enforces this rule at the structural schema level, the privacy mechanism travels securely with the data itself.
Oh, that's brilliant.
If the raw data is exchanged between two different software systems or downloaded to a hard drive or moved to a new server, the Tier 2 private log is baked into the actual DNA of the record.
So it can't be bypassed.
The protection cannot be accidentally stripped away by a faulty website update or a glitchy user interface.
So it's less like locking the data in a safe where someone could eventually steal the key, and more like writing the data in invisible ink?
Yes.
Perfect analogy.
The protection is permanently baked into the document itself, no matter whose hands it ends up in. You are protecting the people of the present with the exact same rigor that you are preserving the evidence of the people of the past.
It is all part of a unified commitment to the integrity of the data.
It's fascinating.
Every record type in the system, whether it's a birth certificate, a gravestone, a tax roll, or a photograph, carries different historical expectations and different privacy burdens.
Right.
A birth certificate reliably gives you a date and a place. A newspaper clipping might not give you either of those things, but it gives you a rich narrative of a community event.
Right. Totally different kinds of evidence.
The schema guides both how we extract that information scientifically and how we protect the subjects ethically. To synthesize all of this for you listening, the genealogical record of humanity isn't just a collection of normalized names and standardized dates on a sterile chart.
It's really not.
It is a massive collection of highly specific, localized moments. Moments when the state or a church or a local newspaper took notice of an individual human being on a specific day.
Exactly.
The Max Record Schema honors those distinct moments by flat out refusing to clean them up. It refuses to modernize them, fix their spelling, or make them pretty for a search engine algorithm.
Right. It preserves the messiness.
By demanding that the evidence remain messy, complex, and exact, it leaves a perfect scientific trail for us and for future AI to follow.
It is a commitment to raw accuracy that ensures all the downstream interpretations, all those massive family trees, the historical migration maps, the sociological analyses, are actually built on a foundation of trustworthy evidence.
Which leaves me with a final lingering thought for you to ponder as we wrap up. We have spent this entire deep dive talking about how crucial it is to save the beautiful, messy, typo-written truth of the past so that future AI and future researchers can accurately understand how things actually were.
Right.
But look at our world right now. Look at how much of our current digital history we are actively cleaning up today.
Oh, wow.
We autocorrect our text messages before we send them. We aggressively filter our photos to remove blemishes. We standardize our digital profiles to fit into neat little drop-down menus.
We really do.
So if future historians and future AI rely on the raw, unedited, messy truth to understand who we really were, wait, I mean, how much of our own history are we actively ruining right now for the researchers of the year 2300?
That is a terrifying and, well, entirely valid question to leave on.
Definitely something to think about the next time your phone automatically corrects your last name to something else. We're all just a makeswell waiting to happen. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
Thanks for having me.